This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, July 3rd. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us. Coming up this week.
You know, with the port motor numbers, to me, the run isn't going to materialize to the extent that they said.
An eager fishing fleet is wondering if this year is going to be a bust. We'll get an update from the grounds this morning. Another of Bristol Bay's revered elders passed away this week. Hjalmar Ofi Olsen succumbed late Wednesday to kidney failure.
A big shock to everyone, even though, again, we all knew that his health was in the decline. But just really sorry to see him go.
Plus, we'll visit a home pack processor in Naknek that's found a way to make small processing work. From marketers to tin salesmen, there's a growing push in the seafood world to increase the popularity of canned salmon. And the mother of a young man from Dillingham, who was killed by his addiction to opioid drugs, speaks out.
It's the most painful thing to watch another human being struggle with an addiction. I almost couldn't believe it. I almost couldn't believe that that was my son.
Those stories are coming up after a look back at some of the week's news. Through Thursday, the harvest of Bristol Bay sockeye stood at 5.6 million fish, and the total run of sockeye to the bay was 8.6 million. Based on the predicted total run of 54 million with 38 million available for harvest, fishermen are anxiously wondering if and when these fish are going to show.
All in all, it's been a pretty slow build, and now it's July 1st, and we're tightening a couple of belts and putting some more food on the boat and still waiting for the wall of fish.
That was Naknek drifter Lang Solberg speaking with KDLG earlier this week. KDLG News spoke with many fishermen throughout the week, most of whom have been optimistic and biding their time before a big push shows. Greg Marksmiller set nets in the Nooshigak District.
It's been beautiful weather. Not really great fishing weather, but beautiful weather. You know, it's been nice to be out on the boat. And, you know, the moon last night was amazing. And yeah.
The director of commercial fisheries for the Department of Fish and Game, Jeff Regnert, was in Bristol Bay this week. He told KDLG News that the run does appear late or small or both.
You know, there's still time for Kwajalein to be as big as it is, for the wood forecast to come in. So I wouldn't want to say that those aren't going to happen. It has the feeling of being potentially slightly smaller than forecast. That's there just based on history of a run being, if it's that large, when it needs to start, on an, even on average run timing. And the strength in which we would assume it to appear in, it's a little lacking in that department.
Regnert was part of a visit by Commissioner Sam Cotton and Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott. Ahead of a fundraiser Wednesday night in King Salmon, U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski was in Igiagig, and Senator Dan Sullivan was in Dillingham. At a public reception, Sullivan spoke mostly about veterans issues, but also took a minute to praise the fishermen, most of whom were out plying their trade Wednesday.
Fishermen in Alaska, they're the ultimate American small business. What do I mean by that? They take risks. They work super hard. They create a great product. They oftentimes pass down their traditions and their business from family to family. And so we need to help our small businesses, our fishing industry, prosper.
In other fish news from the Bay, catches of sockeye here and elsewhere in the state are showing up small this year, which Molly Dishner spoke about with a Fish and Game researcher this week.
Fish and Game's Chuck Brazil crunched the numbers on fish showing up in nets here in the bay.
We are seeing smaller fish than average. The normal average length for sockeye is 541 millimeters, and this year the average is 514, which is a decrease of just over 5%.
Brazil says they're smaller by weight, too.
The average weight is 5.83 pounds, and right now, what we're seeing in the commercial fishery is the average weights of about 4.87 pounds, which is 17% decrease from the average. We're also seeing the same decreases, about 20%, across the state with sockeye weights.
Brazil says ocean conditions are likely a reason for the decline.
The equity firm that owns Icicle Seafoods announced late last week that the seafood giant was being sold to Indonesian companies Convergence Holdings and Dominion Catchers. Under the deal, Convergence will acquire Icicle's land-based wild seafood processing and farm salmon activities, and Dominion will get the company's harvest and processing vessels and its fishing rights. It's still unclear what will change with the sale, and the financial terms have not been disclosed. The two groups of processors in Alaska that are at odds over who can put the MSC label this year appear to be at an impasse. The state of Alaska has been attempting to facilitate a solution, but Commerce Commissioner Chris Laddick, tapped by the governor to help out, says he doesn't see any progress.
going to be July here, which is going to be the height of the red salmon run in Dillingham. So I don't think there's going to be any resolution to it at this point, not what I've seen.
Silver Bay Seafoods heads up the group of processors who kept the MSC label and appears to be blocking the request by 10 other major salmon producers to buy back in. And Western Alaska continues to burn in many places, and firefighting assets are still stretched thin. This week, 8 smoke jumpers landed on the Paul's Creek fire north of King Salmon as that fire continues to grow and threaten some properties on the outskirts of town. The state says the danger has been mitigated. A report from Portage Creek this morning said the smoke was the worst it's been so far this year, though it was unclear which fire that was blowing in from. The state fire marshal did suspend the ban on fireworks for Naknek, Dillingham, and King Cove ahead of the Independence Day holiday, but the city of Dillingham reinstated its own ban on the sale and purchase of fireworks this week. For more on this week's news, check our website, kdlg.org. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond. I'm Dave Benninger. There are two stories at the top of our list as this week winds up. One is the poor fishing so far around the bay as the fleet waits for what hopefully is a late wall of fish to arrive. The other is the passing of Ophi Olson, an elder in Bristol Bay who left his mark as few others have. Earlier today, I spoke with Robin Samuelson, who offered his thoughts on both. He called by cell phone from the Nooshigak Commercial Fishing District, where he had just made some drift deliveries. I asked him first how the fishing was.
You know, it's real scratchy fishing. There was a few fish in a rip on the flood, and now we've got the ebb going, and fishing's not as good as on the flood, and we'll scrape until the period closes and hopefully end up with 4 bags.
You fish this fishery about as long as anybody out there. What's your instinct telling you about this year's run, Robin?
Well, you know, it's a full moon, and if you look at the moon, a cow will jump over the moon, and that's as much as I believe in the 54 minutes. This has been a scratch fishery from the start, and, you know, with the Port Mueller numbers, to me, the run isn't going to materialize to the extent that they said.
You also wear a couple different hats here with the industry. What's your sense on if this run comes in smaller, maybe it translates to a little bit better price or something?
Oh, definitely, definitely. You know, it was all about supply, and the price should go up for salmon, Bristol Bay sockeye salmon, and that's the probably the only bright spot we're looking at this summer here.
Hey, Robin, let's switch gears. Can I ask you for your thoughts on the passing of Ophi? I suppose you've probably known him your whole life, and certainly had a big role with BBNC and a host of other folks. What's your thoughts this morning?
Well, you know, I got pictures of me hanging on Ophi's neck when I was about 5 years old down in Igushik at his dad's fish camp. He's a relative of mine and one of my best friends. And, you know, I'm real sorry to hear that he passed away. But I know that he's in a better place and he's not suffering like he was suffering. And it's a big loss for Bristol Bay. Seems like a lot of our elders are passing on that makes it kind of sad.
It does seem that way lately. Robin, his health was definitely failing, but Ophi's spirits and his humor stayed sharp and warm right up to the end. Was that your sense as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he invited Jerry Lieboff and I to take a steam with him, and we went in the hut room and we came out. And he says, well, I invited you two out tonight. Robin, you're number one, Paul Bear. Lieboff, you're number two. And we left. And I said, don't talk like that, Ophi. You're not going to die. But, he knew his time was limited. He knew his health was deteriorating real bad. And we're all there to help him and make it as comfortable as we could by visiting him and trying to keep him occupied.
I'm sure that we'll have another chance to talk about this ahead of a funeral service, but what are your thoughts on his legacy for this region?
Well, his legacy, you know, he grew up as a fisherman, as a trapper. That's what he did most of his life. And then he was living in Kalignik, and Kalignik appointed him to the BBNC board as a village rep. And from there, he became the president, CEO, chairman of the board. In fact, he superseded my father, I believe, and done an excellent job of the corporation. And he's known throughout the state of Alaska as one of them guys that his word is as good as gold. His handshake, you don't need six lawyers to sign the paper. You just need OPI to agree to it. And he was well respected, not only in Bristol Bay, but statewide and national also.
Robin, thanks for sharing some thoughts on OPI with KDLG here this morning, and good luck to you fishing out there for hopefully what will be the peak here this weekend.
I hope so. We're all hoping.
A few weeks ago, KDLG filed a story on an evening at Jerry Leboff's house as OPI and some friends dined on the first king salmon of the season. OPI talked for hours that night. We ended that story with this.
What I miss, Dave,
yeah,
is when I was small, young guy, even my first few years in high school, used to go with my dad and some older people, and say we went camping or something,
mm-hmm.
And then when the light went out, you stay there and tell stories, listen to stories. Boy, interesting. Mm. Lots of stories. Mm. Hunting stories, you know, stories about ghosts.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, back in a moment. Continuing our program this Friday, many in Bristol Bay have dreamed of processing and selling their own catch, but the challenges to do so are many. But some around the bay are making it work. Earlier this week, KDLG's Hannah Colton caught up with one four-year-old startup small processor in Naknek. She found that those challenges can be overcome with some grit and elbow grease, a little humor, and a lot of attention to detail. She filed this report.
Amanda Waliszewski will admit, she's a bit of a fish snob. When a salmon comes across her table at Nakeen Home Pack, she makes sure it is coddled every step of the way.
We're always looking for ways to not touch that fish. We changed our processing line, so instead of picking up the fish and handing it across three times, everyone's adjacent to each other. So, and then instead of having to pick up the fish and reach across the table, he just bridges it, slides it across the cutting board. And those things seem a little fussy probably, but they really do make a difference, I think.
Waliszewski admits she might be a little oversensitive, but she says when you see thousands of fish go into fillets, you notice all the little bumps and bruises that can be prevented with a little TLC.
Because we see how beautiful they really can be if they're kept in nice condition. And that same exact fish that came off the boat and kind of got kicked around or that wasn't kept at temperature could have been the same fish that comes through like the ones you saw today. All their scales and just bright and shiny and just perfect. They're perfect.
She's referring to a load of subsistence salmon she picked up from the beach earlier that day.
Do you have the weight on those?
Dave Alto was $295.
In the calm before the storm of commercial fishing, Waliszewski is breaking in a mostly new crew. One of her experienced hands, Shoshana Wilhite, is helping train the five newcomers.
Yeah, they actually all picked it up super fast this year. Like, I've been impressed. And we've been so slow, but we've been getting some practice, so you know, we've gradually gotten more fish every day, so it's been good.
The 9-person team can do about 500 pounds per hour, so it takes them about 40 minutes to get this delivery cut, vac-packed, and into the freezer. While they're cleaning their knives and tables, a truck pulls up in front. It's bringing another load of fish to cut, as well as a gift for the company.
This is a local lady here. She's donating her dog to us for the summer, so we have a bear dog. We have bear and fox, and when they catch a whiff of salmon, we will have them all season. I guess his name is Jim. We'll give him a trial run. This will be his interview, Pam. See if I'm going to hire him.
Okay.
I'm just kidding.
Pam Riddle has been bringing her subsistence fish to Amanda for 4 years now. Riddle does a lot of processing herself, canning, smoking, and salting. But when she wants frozen fillets to ship out of state, she leaves it to Nakeen Homepack.
I don't have the facility she does. And I send it to Washington for my daughter. And this makes it really easy. All I do is just bring her my fish. Amanda's good people. Really good people.
This is how Amanda likes to do business, by word of mouth, with friendly fishermen who come back year after year. And she said, when they're giving fillets to relatives or selling them at farmers markets, fishermen start to pay more attention to how they treat their fish, too.
And then the next year when they come back, they're really tapped into that. They want to know, how's the fish looking? Is it good? We bled all of these. Or, I went to this class this winter on seafood processing or handling or bleeding. And it's really cool to see them put the education part into it.
Of course, as every processor, big or small, discovers, there are challenges to starting a business in Bristol Bay. Waliszewski found it can be hard to find a mechanic during fishing season. It's complicated to ship up supplies and expensive to buy them locally.
It's kind of a thing where, looking back, if you knew what it was going to be like, you would be too intimidated. Or I personally would be too intimidated to do it. So it's almost best not to know what's up ahead. You just go for it and hope somehow, by the grace of God, you make it to the end of the season and everybody gets paid. All the fish are well taken care of, and you're done.
Waliszewski says by the end of each season, she'd be happy to never see another salmon again. But the feeling washes off quickly, like slime from Extra Tufts. By the time each May rolls around, she can't wait to get cutting again. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
Staying with that vein for this next story, despite new ways of marketing and selling salmon, canned fish remains a major product in Bristol Bay. In 2013, 38% of the salmon coming out of the bay was put into cans, but they aren't flying off the shelves. KDLG's Molly Dishner has more about the effort to get younger Americans more excited about canned Alaska fish.
LA marketer Craig Carroll is working with the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute to change that.
I think that canned salmon needs to be positioned with blueberries, literally as a superfood.
He's not the only one who wants to see a resurgence in canned salmon.
It brings tears to my eyes because it's an old business, but it's such a staple business, and people need to eat more canned salmon.
That was Eric Weiss, who sells tin to canneries throughout Alaska, including some in Naknek. His company, Crown Cork and Seal, has worked on developing new, smaller cans that he thinks are more appealing to consumers.
We've actually introduced a new, smaller size to the industry, and it's about the size, the height of a quarter-pound can, and then the diameter of a half-pound can.
But Weiss says there are challenges in getting that new can sold, from inefficiencies for the processors who have to fill more, smaller cans, to convincing stores to carry them. That could be solved if more people were asking for cans. Carroll is trying to increase demand. His target audience? Millennial women, particularly pregnant women and new moms who might be interested in the health benefits of a can of fish and also appreciate the sustainability of Alaska's fisheries. Carroll's wife is an integral part of that effort.
My wife has been developing these amazing salmon burgers with a caper lemon sauce that she mixes up. And the big test for us is, will our 6-year-old son eat it? My 6-year-old is pretty picky, and he really digs these salmon burgers.
Carol hopes that a website with 30 or so recipes tested by his wife will hit home with the mommy bloggers who can spur purchases and eventually help salmon capture a little of the tuna market.
It's really changing people's perception about them and driving the consumer into the shop and forcing the shop to say, hey, you know, we got to move this off the bottom shelf and put it, you know, like 4 feet high so people can see it.
In Dillingham, I'm Molly Dishner.
A few weeks ago on this program, we told you about an effort to change the name of a Western Alaska census district currently named for a Confederate slave owner and Civil War general. KYUK's Ben Matheson has an update.
Governor Bill Walker wrote Wednesday to the Census Bureau to begin the process of changing the name from the Wade Hampton Census District to the Kushlovak Census District. Katie Marquette is the governor's press secretary.
That original name had no connection or to the culture or to the history of Alaska and its people. So with the support from all of those folks that I mentioned, Governor Walker felt that it was only appropriate that Alaska's place names reflect and respect the diversity of our great state.
The city and tribe of the largest community in the area, Hooper Bay, passed a resolution in support of a change and came up with the new local name. A recent Alaska Dispatch News article brought the history to the forefront. Local and state politicians voiced their support for shedding the name of a Confederate general whose rise to political power was in tandem with a terror campaign by a violent white power group, the Red Shirts. Edgar Holscher is the tribal chief for the native village of Hooper Bay.
Everybody knows in the early times that man was a slaver and never had stepped into Alaska, and why should our area be named after someone who we don't even know about?
Wade Hampton's son-in-law was a territorial judge and named a nearby mining district after the South Carolina politician. That showed up in census data in 1920 and stuck. Myron Nanning leads the Association of Village Council Presidents and Sea Lion Corporation of Hooper Bay. He's been organizing behind the scenes to get the new name.
Kusilvak means the high one, and it's the mountain that's located between Scammon Bay and Mountain Village, and that's the highest mountain in the region, in the area, and there's a lot of history associated with it.
The peaks, which rise as high as 2,200 feet, are visible from several villages and are used as a landmark for traveling and navigating. Nanning says that stories tell of a mole or mouse that attempted to carry the mountain to the Bering Sea but stopped short of the coast. Several nearby lakes are shaped like animal prints. Holscher says having a local Yupik name honors the region's people.
It shows that our elders and forefathers were there and were still living on the grounds where they were.
The name is used for statistical record keeping. There's no regional government with the name, but it shows up in countless publications for borough-level information. That will change going forward. Eddie Huntinger is the state demographer. He explains that the Census Bureau will begin to implement the new name in their record systems.
So I don't think it'll be that difficult of a process, and we expect that it'll be in their next borough and census area release of data.
That's expected to be early next year. The governor writes that he will use the new name from now on. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Bristol Bay has struggled as it's watched many of its own become addicted to opioid drugs like heroin and oxycodone. Drug abuse has claimed several lives over the past few years, and another name was unfortunately added to that list this month. 26-year-old George Washington Case, off and on from Dillingham, struggled with addiction for several years. He had a few run-ins with the law on account of it. Notably, he was arrested in Togiak last year after he broke into the village clinic's pharmacy and stole prescription meds. He was in Togiak as a peer mentor, hired by the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation's Behavioral Health Center to speak to area youth about addiction and recovery. On June 1st, in Anchorage, Case fell over from a heart attack and died. It probably wasn't illegal drugs that killed him, but rather the use of over-the-counter Imodium AD, which many addicts use to ease withdrawal symptoms. Overuse of Imodium can be dangerous, especially if an individual has a heart condition, which his family believes was the case. This week, I spoke with George's mother, Eleanor Roll, about George, his struggle, and how his life and death might be an example for others. Eleanor, it's good to speak with you on this program. Thanks for coming on.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Can you first tell me a little bit about George?
George is my firstborn son, and George said had a lot of hope. He had a lot of vision. He had a lot of dreams as a young man, and would keep us up at night just in high school talking about the things he wanted to do and the things he wanted to accomplish. So we would stay up and listen to him and encourage him and told him that he can become anything that he wanted to become and that he had our support in that. I understand that he started with marijuana, and I started noticing a difference after high school when he left home, and I started noticing a real different George. I noticed his behavior became very aggressive. I noticed that his personality changed. I started asking him what was going on, and he wouldn't tell me. He was working in Billingham. It was the first time he got arrested. And then we really knew something was going wrong with George.
Eleanor says during prison visits, George openly discussed the level of his drug use, how he was experimenting with a number of different drugs, and that he knew he had a problem. She says the revelations weren't easy to absorb.
And it really, really scared me. It really, really startled me because that's not how he was raised.
What did you as a family do at this time when you realized that he was addicted?
We came together as a family and we started setting boundaries here at home, started seeing a counselor, and also started letting him know that he had to get help. And it was a roller coaster ride for us because we wanted to be helpful, but we found at some times we would be enabling.
Eleanor says the family learned to practice tough love. George did well in prison, but was struggling when he got out. He was required to frequently meet with his probation officer and take a drug test, and had to follow through with a court-ordered assessment. The requirements, she says, were burdensome, even with the help of a family.
We paid for his assessment, and it would take forever for that assessment to even go through. And we would call week after week after week, and we also drove him to his UA tests pretty much every day when he had to have them. And so people who don't have family support, I don't know how, you know, I can see where it just then becomes a cycle and a pattern of not getting well, not getting what they need.
Let me ask you, Eleanor, during this time, this is after George was no longer in jail, but he was out, but required to meet with the PO regularly.
Mm-hmm.
What was his attitude? Did he seem like he was ready to fight this thing and try and beat it? Or
yeah, well, we confronted him and said, we know you have a problem, and we're here to help you. And he was really ashamed. You know, he was really ashamed and sorry for some of the things that he had done while he was using. And he acknowledged that he needed help. And I could see where he was struggling a lot.
After what Eleanor says was a long wait, George did get into a treatment facility in Anchorage. The family visited him there. Eleanor says George didn't think it was helping him, and after several visits, she began to agree. You were disappointed with the way it was run or handled, and how did he respond while he was in that treatment center?
Yes, we were really disappointed, and he tried to. We told him what you get out of it is what you put into it, and so. He said he was trying, he said, but he would basically call it a joke.
Eleanor, one thing I've heard from other families that have watched a loved ones suffer is that this is maybe the first time they realize that addiction is a disease. Did you come to that realization watching George?
All I know is he suffered greatly. He suffered greatly, and he really needed help.
What advice can you offer to other families who are watching loved ones fall down the same path that George was headed down?
You know, it's the most painful thing to watch another human being struggle with an addiction. I almost couldn't believe it. I almost couldn't believe that that was my son, because he had so many hopes and so many dreams. And, you know, the addiction can get to anyone's home. You can be rich or poor. You can be a family who loves God and loves each other and have values and morals, and it will go to anybody that it can.
Let's talk about the past few months and then how he died.
Was
he doing better towards the end?
Yes. This past year, after George got out of jail, he was doing much better. He lived at the house and told him that he could stay and live here as long as he wasn't using, and that he had to go to his meetings and get his assessment done. He was really doing well this past year. And we told him, anytime you wanted to talk or needed prayer, you let us know. It doesn't matter what time of the day or night it was. And one night, in the middle of the night, 3 o'clock in the morning, he came knocking on our door and said, I really need to talk. I really need prayer. I'm really struggling. And so we, both my husband and I, went downstairs and prayed with him, and he just fell on his knees, and he was weeping and weeping and said, I really need help. And so he was just crying out and praying and asking for help, and then after that, he said, I want to be true, you know, and he just said, I'm going to make a list of people that I need to apologize to.
But she says he didn't finish that list. Eleanor didn't know it at the time, but she says she believes now that George was self-medicating with Imodium AD, an anti-diarrheal medicine which contains the opioid drug loperamide. Some recovering addicts say Imodium helps manage the symptoms of withdrawal. Some mix it with other ingredients to actually try and get high. Either way, it can be dangerous, and Eleanor believes George died from its use on account of a heart condition they didn't know about. She began to notice he was not in good health this spring as he worked outside around the yard.
He started perspiring a lot. He was just really breathing hard and sweating, and I knew there was something going wrong with him, and that he started sleeping like a long time after he would work outside. And then the last week he had been working in my backyard, and I started getting really concerned about his health and asked him if he'd been to the doctor lately, and he said he was planning on doing that. And then he was going for a walk with his cousin to go and buy some clothes with the money he had just made. And he bought some Imodium AD, which I understand he had been taking. And I know that he had been planning to come home to cook, because he absolutely loves to cook for us. But he was out walking, and he just fell right there while they were walking, and he had his heart attack. And 4 years ago, I dreamt he died from that, and I couldn't believe that my dream actually came true. 26 years old, my son died.
That was Eleanor Roll, the mother of 26-year-old George Case, who died of a heart attack June 1st in Anchorage. She told me that George's toxicology report came back negative for other drugs or alcohol and believes it was his self-medicating with Imodium that led to his death. I asked if she hoped George's death would serve as an example for others, a cautionary tale of the consequences of drug use and addiction. She said there were dozens of George's friends at the funeral who saw a dead young man and a grieving family and believes that example is already being set. She said she plans to continue speaking out and speaking up. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond. That's it for this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond, our weekly news magazine on KDLG. Before we go, just a personal note. I had the privilege of visiting many times with Ofi Olson, who passed away this week, and I enjoyed his company and listening to his stories very much. He will be missed. For the last month or so, Ofi called up here to the station nearly every day. I wish I had recorded those conversations. They always ended with him saying, "Hey Dave, you got any polka music you can play? How about some Frankie Yankovic?" He would tell me it reminded him of live music he remembers hearing in his younger years. Well, we didn't have any Frankie Yankovic, but we got some. I'm Dave Benninger. Hope to see you back here next week. This one's for Ofi.
Song of a cheer. Now's time to roll.